Coming up on this episode of the Mario Rosenstock podcast.
A woman opened the door and I said, I'm looking for John. And she went, hey! Right. And at that, she came out, two men came out and dogs came out and they grabbed me. I was literally being dragged. My jacket was ripped. My shirt was ripped. There was a big scratch down my whole body from there to there.
And yet you found yourself relaxing.
I felt massively calm in the middle of it.
Michael O'Toole has been one of Ireland's leading crime journalists for over two decades now. As crime correspondent at the Irish Daily Star, Michael has covered all of the big stories of major criminals, knocking on so many doors that many of us wouldn't dream of ever approaching. And he's had a career that I guess could be described as, well, highly unconventional. We covered so much in our chat, from female fascination of true crime, the question of evil, the skill involved in tabloid journalism itself, and how his very unconventional career has shaped him as a person. As you can imagine, Michael has a lot of fascinating stories to tell.
This is going to sound terrible. I really got on with him. He shot a colleague of mine. Mm-hmm. He was blasé about it. Mm-hmm. Shot her dead as she sat in a car and went away. And I went away going, yeah, I could have been friends with him. And I walked over and I said, how are you doing, sir? We're from the press. Would you mind talking to us? And he went, do you want to talk? And I went, no problem. Very sorry for your loss. And I walked away. The female journalist went, what? Not even a word. That was 25 years ago. And I still remember her being so aggressive to him. You're going to get me in trouble
no,
here.
No, you know the answer to this question. I can see it in your face.
Of course
you just
I
have
do.
To tell me. How do you get to the women? Don't.
No,
don't.
No,
I want the real answer. People will know
this is my truth, I think.
Hi, Michael. Frank Greeny here. Is there a fraternity of crime writers out there? Should we ever meet for a drink? Share stories? Do ye ever meet for a drink and I'm not invited?
This is serious. We have a very elite WhatsApp crime reporters group.
I'm not in it.
No, very few people are.
Fuck that for a game of soldiers, so talk to you later. And we'll also be talking about Michael's foray into the world of crime fiction. His new novel, Blacklight, is out now and is definitely worth popping into someone's Christmas stocking this Christmas. Our full chat coming up very shortly. But first, comedy. Exclusive comedy on the Mario Rosenstock podcast. Let's go straight over to another rival podcast, friendly rivals, the David McWilliams podcast, as David looks forward to Christmas and an economic roundup of the year. Okay, end of year economic review, David.
I'm all over it, JD.
Let's just keep it simple this time, okay? Pure economics.
Pure economics, straight down the middle.
Here we okay, go. Off you go.
Yeah, ready for this? Microphone, heads on. Ah, how are you doing? And a happy Christmas to all the listeners of the podcast out there from myself, David, and John.
Happy Christmas, guys.
We're going to do an end of year economic roundup, a smorgasbord of everything that's happened during the year, John.
That sounds great, David.
And I love a good swim at Christmas, John.
Ah, you're a hearty soul.
But as a great economist once said, it might have been me.
Yeah.
when the tide goes out, only then will you find out who's wearing togs.
Ah, brilliant. This is a great episode. Christmas, David. Christmas.
Christmas.
Yeah,
well,
economics.
Let's think about Christmas. When I think about Christmas, I think of... Ah, oh, Jesus, I remember the old crimbobbles. I'm freezing our bollocks off on the main streets of Dalkey.
Never happened.
Crowding and huddling around the fire in a rusty barrel on Sorrento Road.
Would you shut
the fingers cut off the end of our mittens and our fingernails full of shite.
Ah, listen, you're full of shite.
And a bag of those soggy chips between the 15 of us scavenging into them like seagulls we were in Dalkey.
Ah, David.
And then staring into the windows of all the posh fucks, the poshies like the young Pat Kenny.
Hey kids, Daddy's going to present Eurovision. We're loaded.
And me poor old fella smashing up the furniture at home so we don't bore, so we don't freeze to death.
He never did that.
I died of cold. We hadn't a fucking bean, John. So poor.
David.
We didn't have a Christmas tree or nothing.
David.
We had to draw a fucking tree on the wall with a cheap piece of chalk.
I'm starting my own podcast. Fuck off.
The only presents we had, John, were not having the nuts kicked off us by the knackers up and
by.
John? John, where are you going?
Christy here. You're listening to the top comedy podcast in Ireland, as voted in the Irish Podcast Awards. Congratulations, Mario Rosenstock.
And remember, exclusive comedy every week on the Mario Rosenstock podcast. And if you want to come and see me live, you can see me live in person. I'm going to be on tour with Gift Grub Live 2023 all over Ireland, from Kerry to Cork, Galway, Waterford, all over the place, Drogheda, and of course Dublin's Olympia Theatre. I'm on tour from February 24th through March and through April. Just go to Gift Grub Live on Ticketmaster to pick up those tickets. I look forward to seeing you there. It's a brand new show and I can't wait to get it on the road. Okay, let's get straight to my chat with Michael O'Toole. He's been with the Irish Daily Star for over 20 years now, but initially, a tabloid newspaper was certainly not the place he had pictured himself working, as he explains himself.
I came out of journalism college in 1993, right, and I was working for the Irish News. It's a very, you know, I was interviewing the Taoiseach and, you know, all that. It was Bertie Ahern. I got him at the time to say, and this was, you know, at the height of decommission with the IRA, I got him to say on the front page, the IRA will decommission. Because everybody had been saying the IRA are not going to decommission. And he said, oh, they're going to decommission. And 2 years later they did. So it was a big hit, you know. So I went from that to, do I really want to work in a tabloid? I was a complete intellectual snob. But as soon as I walked in the door, actually a good friend of mine, Jeremy McDermott, who runs a court agency in Dublin, he said to me, Michael, the Star is great for news. If you're a newsman, and he knew I was a newsman, go and work there. And from day one, I fitted like a glove. So the Star has a really good reputation for breaking stories. It just fitted, and I'm happy as I can be.
And in the same way, actually, as I would have been a bit of an intellectual snob about papers as well. But then as I got older, I realised, well, for example, some of the most cleverest people would be working in The Sun, because to write a story in a kind of a tabloid way requires a skill, a skill which is different and pithier and politically aware. And also they would have been brilliant, for example, on sport, for example, like that kind of stuff.
I think it was Mark Twain who said, look, when he was writing somebody a letter, he said, listen, I'm really sorry. I don't have time to write you a short letter. I'll have to write you a long one. Right? And I always think this writing
excellent,
this book,
yeah,
because it's really hard to, and God, this is really deeply analytical, but my first iteration of the book, I tried to ignore my tabloidism or whatever you want to call it. And I wrote it in a very flowing, you know, lovely sub-clause and very long sentence.
You went back to being an intellectual wanker again.
Yes, Michael, yeah. And it was shocking, right? And thankfully I sent it off to an agent in London. That's why you send off the first chapters to an agent.
Bit wanky.
He basically said it was shite, right? And I actually emailed him the other day just to say, listen, your honesty was what I needed, right? Because I don't know about your business, but see in writing and novel work and all that, there are so many fake people who go, Michael, I was totally gripped by this novel, but it's just not for me. And they're talking out of their arses. Just say you don't like it and say what is wrong about it. And I wrote an email to thank him and say, listen, your honest criticism really helped me as a writer. And this book is only here because of your bluntness, and I really appreciate that.
And so from crime journalism to crime novels, but you're not going to leave the crime journalism, are you?
No,
okay, so you're going to put one in tandem with the other.
Yes.
Okay, here's a question then that would occur to me. Is truth stranger than fiction?
Yes. Say, for example, there's a, look, it's in front of the Special Criminal Court, there's no problem about sub judice. There's the ongoing Gerry Hodge trial about the monk, about the Regency Airport Hotel attack. Okay. If you were to tell me, if I was actually writing Black Light when that happened, so I started working on it in late 2015. Okay, so the Regency Hotel was in 2016, right? And that took up a huge amount of my time. But if you were to tell me that chain of events happened, I would say I would not believe that. If I were to put that in Black Light, you know, you work through the thought process, I would have said, that's not credible,
yeah,
right? Because one of the things I've really attempted to do in the book is to make it as authentic as possible, okay? From a policing perspective, because I have lots of friends who are guards and I can't really write stuff that's nonsensical because they won't talk to me again. But there's lots of journalism in the book and I wanted people to see what it's like to be a journalist, because I'm loath to say this and I'm sorry to say this, but most Irish fiction deals with journalism appallingly. The stuff I've read, I have thrown books across the floor because I've been so angry about the portrayal of journalists. I've also, you know, the portrayal of guards as well.
Your classic portrayal of journalists then in fiction?
Right. So one of the things we do is we go knocking doors, right? That's fine. People object to it. No problem. But can you imagine if you'd just lost a loved one And Nick O'Toole, the tabloid representation in media or in fiction, comes up, bangs on your door and says, let me in, I have to talk to you. Do you think, would you consider opening the door?
No.
Right. So the way that journalists connect with somebody, you connect, I find, when you...
Softly.
We call it a doorstep or a death knock, right? And I've done hundreds of them, unfortunately. And it's all about, you have about 2 seconds, right? And you have to show empathy there and then. So you're soft, you're considerate, you're polite, you're approachable. Now, you have to do your job, but, you know, you can't bully your way into talking to somebody. And I've seen too many portrayals of, you know, I remember years ago watching one, EastEnders actually, and there was a hack in the hospital and he didn't underhand a thing. And I was going, oh, Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
It's just, you know what? We get a bad press and that's our fault.
Got
but
it.
We do.
Got it. Empathy
yes.
at the door.
Yes.
Have you worked at it? Did you, for example, you've... Then you did it again a few weeks later or a few months later, and did you go, I must change that little routine I do in the first 3 seconds or 4 seconds? In fact, tell me what your routine is.
I don't have a routine.
Well, not a routine. What's your...
Some people do.
What's your ploy?
My ploy is to be totally open and honest. And I'm not going to say vulnerable, but slightly meek. So I come with no pre-prepared plan.
Or threat.
But I do know journalists, you know, there's a fellow, fantastic journalist, and one of the things he does, I'm different. I knock on the door and step back just to give him a bit of space, right? What he would do would knock on the door and stick out his hand straight away, right?
That's a little invasive.
Well, no, I mean...
He's making friends, but it's a little invasive.
Where I step back, and one of the things that I insist on is, because there are horror stories about this, it's terrible, I insist on saying I'm a journalist repeatedly and slowly and loudly. Because say...
What do you mean there are horror stories?
Well, I know, I can think of two colleagues of mine who... People are numbed, right, when they lose loved ones. And there's so many things happening and, you know, so many things going on and so many people calling to the door. And I know of two cases... Journalist friends of mine who they knocked on the door, said they were journalists, were brought in and were brought to see the body, and they had to stop a male journalist I know very well. He was brought to the coffin, right? He said he was a journalist at the door, but he just
didn't go in. Yeah, yeah.
And he was at the coffin and they said, no sir, sorry, I said I'm a journalist, and it got very heavy, very very heavy, very very quickly.
Ooh.
Right, so I said, you know, I'm a journalist, I'm with the Star, you know. And so, I mean, one thing I would do, I would sort of rub my hands like this, sort of Uriah Heep sort of way. Look, I learned to do this in the Troubles. I started in journalism in 1993. In 1994, I went to work experience to Belfast, where I'm from. And I was studying in Scotland, so we all went off on work placement for a month. And everybody in Scotland was going to, you know, flower fairs and, you know, council meetings and stuff. I went to a newspaper and they sent me out to doorstep the family of a man who'd been shot dead the day before. And I was terrified. But in a way, it was the best thing that ever happened, because I got it out of the way. Because, look, you know, it's probably a secret that journalists don't like doing this, and journalists are afraid of doing this, and a lot of journalists won't do it. I know journalists who just can't. The older I get, the harder I find it to do, I have to say, because I have kids. And they all, look...
No, similarly, Michael, and
they all stay with me.
Well, just even if, just to relate what you do to sportsmen, let's say.
Yes.
They say that the older you get as a sportsman and the more experienced you get, or a sportswoman, the more nervous you get. Not the less nervous you get. Because the older you get, the more you realise how much it means. What's on the line, and that you may have family and yourself, and that you have the ability to put it in perspective. When you're younger, you have more certainty. More surety. You are sure of yourself. You're cock-a-hoop.
Yeah.
And you don't see the future or the past so clearly.
Yeah.
When you're a little older, everything becomes more meaningful.
And concentrated.
And concentrated, because you just have that little bit more years in you. And that's what they say about sportsmen. I'm more nervous, not less nervous than I used to be.
I'm definitely more nervous doing doorsteps now than I was before. Now, I was assaulted a couple of years ago. That did affect me, I admit it.
Tell me about that one.
A woman was charged over it. Essentially, it was, you know what, we take serious precautions when we're doing doorsteps. For example, things you would never think of. When we were driving into an estate, right, we would say the house is here, you drive into the estate, you go to the end of the estate and you come back so your car is facing out the way in case you have to get out of Dodge very quickly.
Okay.
Right? And, you know, we take all these precautions. So I was doing one And I knocked on a door. It was a fella. It wasn't even, it was a stupid story. I knocked on a door and I said, look, I'm looking for X. And it was a sort of funny story, right? It was a guy who had been done for a bomb threat, right? But it was a stupid bomb threat and he was in the papers and we just decided we'll go and talk to him. It was a court chase, a follow-up, right? Knocked on the door, looking for John Smith. That's not his name. And he went, oh, no, no, he lives up there, right? I said, Grant, thanks very much. And I went up and they were waiting for me. Now, I actually have a recording of it and I'll do it. This is one of the things I do when I'm doing a doorstep. You may hear this, this door knock. So it's not a confrontational door knock. It's not banging. It's quite soft and playful. And
well known by all of us.
Yeah, exactly. It's, you know, it's nothing serious.
It's communicating, yeah. Exactly. It's not.
Exactly, right. Because if you hear that, you go, oh. So that's one of the things I do. I do a sort of soft and gentle door knock, right. And a woman opened the door and I said, I'm looking for John. And she went, hey, right. And at that, she came out, two men came out and dogs came out and they grabbed me. And I could hear the dogs barking and I thought they were going to set the dogs on me. And it lasted about 30 seconds. And you know the weird thing about it? I felt massively calm in the middle of it. I'm a very flighty person, but see when it hits the fan, tremendously calm. I was literally being dragged. My jacket was ripped. My shirt was ripped. There was a big scratch down my whole body from there to there.
And yet you found yourself relaxing.
Perfectly calm.
Yeah.
And it just taught me that, you know, in the eye of the storm, it's one of the things I'm quite proud of about myself. In the eye of the storm, I'm very calm.
And you can't teach that. That's probably something that's inbuilt.
I think so.
Genetically in
I
you.
I think so, yeah. So, and I've had various other incidents, you know, threats and that sort of stuff. Yeah. And I just remember.
It's a nice quality.
I thank God for it, but it, you know, because, well, I wish it was the other way around because incidents like that are very rare, but I'm a very flighty and dramatic person when that's not happening.
Yeah.
So, it, you know, whereas you would expect that you'd be calm and flighty when it hits the fan, but I'm the other way around.
Yeah.
When it hits the fan in a crisis,
yeah,
I'm no better man.
Now that you're talking about your doorstep, method, I actually took a photograph here, right?
Oh, dear.
And this is you. And I think it's your Twitter profile.
Oh, it is, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a Twitter profile. Just to explain to the listeners, it's you at the door, right?
Yes.
And who are the two people at the door? Or can you say?
Oh, I can say.
And what's happening in this? Because the two men, let me explain. The two men at the door, they look like right bruisers. One fella's got a mustache and a bit of a belly on him and he's scowling at you. And the other fella is at the door as well. They're both standing in the door. He's grey haired. He looks a bit like John Gilligan. It isn't John Gilligan, though.
It is John Gilligan.
Oh, it is. Jesus. And there's you. Tell us about that picture.
So that's... I love that picture. That look, you can see the scowl that Gilligan has given me.
Yeah.
I will friggin' kill you. You know.
Yeah. Anyway, the other guy's so giving you a worse guess.
That's his brother Thomas.
Right.
So essentially, that was November 2013, and he'd come out of Port Leisha prison 4 hours earlier. We had been camped at Port Leisha prison for a day. We brought sleeping bags and everything. We were all camped. There were about 100 of us, maybe 50, and there was a high speed motorbike chase. When he got out of prison, it was for drugs. He'd been charged with the murder of our colleague, Veronica Gearn. He was acquitted of that, but he was convicted of drugs and he got 20 years, right? And he spent a long time. He was in prison from 1996, really, until 2013. So he got out and it hit the fan totally. And I was there in my car and we had a photographer on a motorbike and we're literally talking in the movies, a high-speed chase. Now, I was bollocks, so I just let them get on with it. There were three of us there, right? But we realised that he was in... it's Clondalkin. His brother lives in Clondalkin, right? So we realised he was there and we were driving around and somebody said, did you go and talk to him? Right? And I went, fuck it, I will. Now, one of the last journalists he approached was murdered. So, you know, it's a bit dodgy.
Also, on film, the Veronica Gearn knocks on his door.
Well, and she got suffered
the
a very serious...
out of her.
And he beat the crap out of her and she... went ahead with the assault charge and she was murdered before the assault charge could be heard. But, you know, it was... So, no, but I laugh about this because there were lots of journalists there. I was the idiot who walked up to the door, right? And see when that's happening, he started talking. And when he started talking, there were like flies around shite. Four or five of them, other journalists came to me. And I was going, frick sake, lads, where were you 2 minutes ago when I was walking up? It's like the long mile or the long walk. Do you know that? You do the walk yourself. I was going, fuck yes. You could have done this with me 2 minutes ago when I was walking up by myself. So I was the idiot who had the knock on his door and he came out and he gave great lines. And I had a row with a friend
of mine.
What
did he say?
I'm innocent, I didn't do it, all that sort of stuff, right. You know. But I had a row with
him. But did he not tell you to fuck off?
No, he was grand. And then I actually, last year I won a new Crime Journalist of the Year award for getting, one of the reasons was we got Gilligan again. He was in Spain and we staked him out for 3 or 4 days and we got him. So we won an award for that. So we've been chasing him down. But one of my friends who was a journalist with me at the time, he was for another paper. I did the door knock. You know, they all came along when he opened the door and started talking and he videoed it, right? So his only contribution was to say, John, you're looking well. Whereas I'd asked him all the questions about, did you kill Veronica Guerin? I put it to you, you killed Veronica Guerin. And my mate went, oh, you're looking well. And he videoed it, right? Mm. And he got all these hundreds of thousands of hits. I wasn't a video, you know, I was an ordinary journalist that then didn't know anything about the internet, really. And I went balubas because I said, you're getting all the glory of this going round and you're going up on your website. And it's me asking the questions and you come along and say, you're looking well, John. Anyway, we made it up. But yeah, so it was fun.
Michael, when you are speaking to these perps, are bad guys, have you developed an opinion of their character over the years? I'll try and explain a bit more. So when you look into the eyes of people like this, do you see something that rings a bell? Do you see something that forms a pattern? Do you see similar things over the years? Have you formed an opinion that suggests, for example, I'm looking into the eyes of somebody, I can almost see badness?
No.
Okay.
That's the terrifying thing for me. It's my news editor, Billy Scanlon, talks about the banality of evil. And even in the book, we'll talk about the book
it's,
in a while, right?
It's a good expression, I've heard it before. Yeah.
Let me give you a perfect example. Mm. Talking about Gilligan, the man named in court as the murderer, the person who shot Veronica Guerin, was a guy called Patrick Dutchy Holland. Okay? Now, he's dead. And he was a killer. I believe the Gardaí, I mean, a female Garda did stand up in court and say, this man shot Veronica Guerin. I interviewed him in Rome when he was released from prison. And this is going to sound terrible. I really got on with him. Mm-hmm. I connected with him.
It doesn't sound terrible.
And he shot a colleague of mine. Mm-hmm. He was blasé about it. Mm-hmm. Shot her dead as she sat in a car and went away. And I went away going, you know, and I met him at a gangster's funeral about a year later and he remembered me. Oh, Mick, how's it going? Mm. And I was thinking, God, I could have been friends with him. Mm-hmm. And another years ago in 2003, I did a book about the real IRA who blew up OMA, killed 29 people, including a mother who was pregnant with kids. And my colleague John Mooney and I, we did this book called Black Operations. It was very well received, but as part of that, I spoke to very senior dissident Republicans, very, very senior. And I remember talking to one of them, I met them a couple of times, and I remember walking away going, I know what that man has done, I know what his organisation have done, I could be very good friends with that man. Mm-hmm. I just connected with him.
Yep.
So unfortunately, there's no mark of Cain.
No.
And I mean, this is one of the things that really fascinates me about this. People are very good at hiding their evil.
Mm.
And you could be walking down the street. It's like, you know, like I mean, I know it's a sensitive issue. Say child abuse. How many men do we know who are the life and soul of the party, you know, great pillars of society and go home and abuse their kids? And they compartmentalize that. And that's a fascination for me.
It is. And it's not just in the field of crime. Mm. We know nothing about people.
We don't.
And we think we do. Mm. And we go... You know, I had a conversation with Matt Cooper recently about, I was sharing with him, I had a kind of a disjointed childhood and my parents always fought all the time and I was kind of moving from house to house and all this sort of stuff. And I used to think that my friends, when they went home, they walked behind this door and there was a fire on inside and Mum had their dinner ready and Dad said, sit in my knee and watch the TV with me and we'll watch sport and I'll bring you out to sport tomorrow. And it was this idyllic life. And of course, I was wrong. You know, because nobody knows what goes on behind closed doors. Everybody compartmentalizes everything, including in the fields of crime.
That's one of the things I try to, when I'm speaking to people. Somebody once said, you can love the sinner, but not the sin. And I try to take, look, you know, we hockey criminals, who go after sex offenders, no problem. But, you know, when I'm talking to people or, you know, especially very few murders are planned. An awful lot of murders happen or spur of the moment. And, you know, and I've sat from murder, I've spoken to murderers and you sort of, I try to see, on a personal level, I try to see the humanity in everybody. Does that make sense?
Even no, it does, Michael. Michael, listen, we all scrabble through with our own, we all cobble together as well our own homespun philosophies based on our own experience. And I've come to a conclusion which I'm sure will be revised, but at the moment it stands at this. The score is at the minute, good people do bad things, bad people do good things. And that's where I am kind of at the moment. And the more I see of people in life, the more you can't just necessarily blanket people with, you know, but with a word. But at the same time, I did write down the word evil in front of me, and that's what I want.
It's something
I wanted to.
I struggle with that.
You talked about the banality of evil, and that's fine. You got me. I get you. But have you thought about what evil is then, from your perspective?
Look,
and what is evil? Is a man who, or a woman, is a man who is available to do a hit on somebody for €9,000? Is that evil?
No, I don't think
what
so.
What is it?
Evil is. There have been very few people that I have met who I would consider evil, right? Gangland criminals, most of them are not. A lot of them are dysfunctional families. A lot are forced into crime. I mean,
and a lot of are almost pathological or life trained that this is their way. This is their path.
Yeah. So for me, and you know what? This is why blacklight. I'll tell you where it comes from. Just to digress for a moment, because it's about this. Blacklight is ultraviolet light that law enforcement use at crime scenes. When you can't see, when normal light doesn't work. So it's you do it in the darkness and it's, you know, basically ultraviolet light, and you see, you know, looking for blood or semen or saliva.
Like
so
night vision goggles?
You know, yeah, but infrared.
Infrared.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's what it's black light, and it's used in the novel because there's a woman is a
great title,
woman.
Yeah.
Right. But you know what? It's actually more than that. It's an allegory. And the hero is a guy called John Lazarus, and he believes that there's a black light in everybody, right? And that some people fight it. And some people surrender to it. Now, black light is evil for him, right? But for me, it's evil, I don't know if even is the right word, but just a lack of empathy. Or there's a darkness in some people, right? There's a darkness in all of us, but in some people, the darkness wins out. I'm going to give you a perfect example, right? I said I started writing this book in 2015. The reason I started writing the book in 2015, I wanted to write it for 20 years. The reason I started writing a book in 2015 is I covered a case of a man called Graham Dwyer. You may remember that.
I do.
It was human life. It was. I covered that case. I sat this close to him, right, for 30 days or however long it was. And I was just fascinated by, he was able to compartmentalise his life, right? He was a loving father, middle class architect, had a slightly geeky a hobby I would quite like of flying model aircraft. That's the second part of his life. And the third part of his life is he was a sexual sadist. And he pretty lived together with that. There's a thing called moral injury, right? I bet you if you were driving down the road and you ran over a cat, you'd be beating yourself up probably for a couple of days, probably longer. That's moral injury. I would be the same. Oh my God, what did I do that for? Why did I say that thing to that person when I had a few scoops in it before? Graham Dwyer planned a murder of a human being. He spent months working out how to kill her, how to lure her to her death, how to groom her for murder. Now, I was fascinated and repelled by that man, by what he did. Because, as I said, most murders are spur of the moment, or they're forced into it, or it's chaotic. He sat down and said, I'm going to find a woman, I'm going to groom her, I'm going to murder her, and I'm going to leave her in the Dublin Mountains. And I just could not get my head around to that. So that's why Blacklight came about, because obviously there's a bad guy in this. And it's about, there is a darkness. I think this, there's a, the only way I can explain this is there's a darkness in some people. Now, is it nature or nurture, right? There's another infamous killer. I won't say who he is, but I remember speaking to a guard. He brought him to justice. And this man, he did another sort of bit of psychopathic lack of empathy killing. Really bad one, right? And when he was a kid, his father was an alcoholic. And he used to beat up the family. And the sister had special needs. And he, when he was a child, he used to have to hide under the bed with the sister to protect her. Right? So, you know, without sounding terribly intellectual, wasn't it? W.B. Yeats talked about too long a sacrifice makes a stone of the heart. Right? And I look at these people who have become psychopaths. And there are psychopaths. I mean, there are psychopaths who are damaged. And I just wonder, were they born that way, or was it their life circumstances that changed them. So, but I don't know with Graham Dwyer, because I know, I mean, I would have said Lodi's father, he comes from a loving family, a normal family.
Well, that you know.
That we,
Classic psychology, of which I know little, but everybody knows a little bit, would suggest that what happens to us in the first 3 years of our life is elemental to what's going to happen to us in the rest of our life,
according to
one branch of psychology.
Right.
So you can come from a loving family, yet you may have had traumatic incidents in the first 3 years for some reason or another.
It's funny, there's another, this guy, I think I mentioned earlier, this guy Eamon Dunn, right? He was involved in 18 murders. He was caught trying to kidnapping a guy. He was involved in terrible, terrible killing women, everything. And he decided to get involved in criminality. He's one of the few people I know who said, I want to have that life. Because he was working in a factory. He, working class kid, like most working class kids, I'm a working class kid. He wasn't involved in crime. His family wasn't involved. He just decided, I'm going to get involved in crime. Most people, you know, that's chaotic lives and there's
pushed
issues.
Into it.
They're pushed into it. Commas. You know, and you know, and they're unwilling and they get caught up in it, shall we say.
Yeah.
Right. He went, that's for me. Fascinating. Totally fascinating.
Well, most people would describe, from our tokenistic knowledge and definition of evils, is something that you almost alluded to there, which is suggested by the Graham Dwyer situation. And that is that a person who is ontologically functional, a person that is functional and successful, a person that adheres to the general moral rules of society and is seen to follow the law legally and morally, and yet outside of this plans this despicable act. This is our definition of evil as a society.
I think so.
Yeah. Was this what you meant?
Yes, because you know, that darkness in him. That, so in other words, if everybody has, you know, there's good and bad in this, or there's darkness and light, and there's black light.
Sure.
For me, the darkness, for whatever reason, won out in him.
Yeah,
and he decided to end a life. Premeditated. I've covered probably 800 murders. Very, very few of them have been premeditated. You know, the difference between murder and manslaughter is intent. You can intend within 5 seconds to kill somebody or cause them serious harm. Graham Dwyer spent months planning to kill somebody.
Yeah, this is the planning of the evil, yeah.
I'm still flabbergasted by it, I have to say.
Absolutely.
Seven years later.
Just tangentially, though, if I can just get a spin off on a slight tangent for a minute. You mentioned psychopath, the word psychopath. And I'm interested in this word because I put forward an argument to you. I propose to you.
Oh.
I propose to you that far from despising or criminalizing psychopaths in our society, we create them. We like them. We aspire to be them. We put them in positions of power all the time.
Oh,
and we watch them act out their psychopathy and we do nothing about it. So what I mean by that is our entire setup of our milieu, our entire mores, social mores, our entire professional structure, our entire economic structure, and indeed legal and structure and constitutional structure, is based on the idea that if you are a successful psychopath, you'll win. You will become a CEO.
Yes.
You will be able to walk into a room, summarily fire 2,000-3,000 people, no problem. Go home, sleep easy at night, because that's something that good psychopaths are able to do. You will also be able to bully successfully somebody in court who is much weaker than you and go home and sleep soundly at night. You'll be able to push people around. You're giving me, just for those at home, his lips are pursed. He's not agreeing with what I'm saying.
I am actually. I'm thinking about people I've come across in my career.
So what I'm saying is we say on one hand, psychopaths are bad, yet we create psychopaths by the nature and the unfeeling and cruel nature of our society all the time. I mean, just give you some facts. It was a survey they did on CEOs across America, and some massive percentage were found to fit into the psychopathy bracket.
See, you know, this is why I'm a humble tabloid hack. That's way above my pay scale. It sounds
me too, but
it sounds eminently plausible, and it makes sense to me because, you know, how can I look, I've been the counsellor, I have no problem. And my counsellor, I mean, I think everybody should, because the nature of my job, and I know guards go, right? The counsellor talks about me having lots of empathy. Now, that's good for my job, but it means that it causes me difficulties. And I couldn't go and sack somebody, right? I couldn't sack half of Twitter That's it, you're gone. I shouldn't be able to do that. So maybe you're right.
For me, neither.
So maybe there is. Maybe, look, listen, you had me at hello. It's a very convincing
argument. Ability to highly compartmentalise, you know, something. There's elements of psychopathy involved.
Yeah, so I look at it from the criminal perspective, which is the extreme when you're killing somebody. But of course, I mean, sure, it makes total, now that you said it, makes total sense that there are psychopaths in other realms of society.
How interesting the name of your book, Black Light. I love the story behind that. And I'm interested in the Graham Dwyer. He actually lived near me.
Do you know what? It's annoying. I don't even like giving him the airspace of letting him know because I don't like him and he doesn't like me. We've had a few interactions, but it is. I can't say there were two inciting factors.
When you say you've had a few interactions.
He's complained and stuff and, you know, and you get letters and I let him at it. And, you know, I was told by various sources that he wouldn't be my biggest fan. That's fine. And if he's a feelings mutual, that's grand. But he was the inciting factor. Great. One of two.
Great. And one of the other things about your book, just steer me right or wrong if I'm right or wrong about this. So the detective Sergeant John Lazarus is loosely based on a person called Mick Moran.
Yes, he is.
And tell us a little bit about Mick Moran, if you feel that's an interesting way to go.
I tell everybody about Mick Moran because he is one of the reasons why this book was written. In 2008, he's a what they call a cyber cop now. He's one of the world's leading experts in child protection online. Okay, so he was a detective Garda in a Garda unit called the National Bureau of Criminal Investigation, who handled serious crime investigations. And in 2002, he became involved in the Garda's fight against what is laughably or ridiculously called child pornography. It's called that in the law. I call it child sex abuse material. And most campaigners and most Gardaí would call it CSAM. Because it just sends out the right message. Because, you know, unfortunately, I've seen some incidents and it's horrendous. And, you know, just calling it child porn or kiddie porn or child pornography minimises the damage to the kids.
Yeah.
Right? It's not pornography. It's children being abused in the most horrendous ways. So anyway, so Mick Morney's... He basically coordinated a Garda operation in 2002 called Operation Amethyst, which was the first major Garda crackdown on child sexual abuse material online. There were about 100 people brought through the judicial system. Most were charged and convicted, others weren't. But it was very, very high profile. There were a lot of high profile men who ended up in court over this. Anyway, so, and he was the leading expert on child sexual abuse material in the Guards. He went in 2007 to Interpol in France, Lyon, the Interpol HQ, and he became an assistant director in charge of child sexual exploitation. And in 2008, my photographer colleague Jim Walpole and I went over to interview him because he'd been in the news and Interpol said we could. And I was interviewing him in a room like this, and he had big earphones like you have on a bookcase to the left of his computer. And I don't know why, but I said, Mick, what is the story with those headphones? Why are they so big? In fact, they're bigger than yours. And he went, I wear them when I'm watching child sexual abuse material videos so nobody else can hear the babies or the children screaming.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, God.
And then under controlled conditions, he played a video.
Yeah.
And I'm talking to you now, I can hear the screams. I can hear the screams of that baby in my head as I'm talking to you. I didn't watch it. I saw it was out of turn. I just couldn't.
Do you have children?
I do have three. Yeah. But I turned away and I couldn't watch it. But I should have put my hand up to my ears. I couldn't get away from the screams. Right. And it lives with me to this day. It's a very famous video, actually. It's well known within law enforcement about the baby. Jesus Christ. But anyway, so it just struck me, right, that here's a copper who goes into the darkness so we don't have to, who goes into the most depraved corners of the internet. And anyway, in essence, that was 2008, and I always wanted to write about how does a Garda, who does this horrible job, how does he or she cope? I thought through fiction I could explore the rationale and the effect. I mean, look, in the book, you know, he's got a wife and kids, and his wife is at him to give up this job because it's wrecking him, it's killing him. Now, he does it because his own sister was kidnapped, raped and murdered and dumped in the mountains. And, you know, he was supposed to pick her up from work from when she was out that night, but he was in looking after a prisoner and he missed her by 5 minutes. And she was abducted around the Shelburne area of the city centre, Shelburne Hotel. And, you know, it says, and the wife says, you're trying to protect the woman you can't protect because she's dead. And he has thrown himself into the darkness, sort of vicariously trying to solve that crime because he can't investigate his own sister's murder. So he delves into the darkness to protect other women and kids because he thinks he feels protecting his own sister. So that was the rationale for it, yeah. Basically.
You spoke there about the effect on people's lives and the people who do it. Your own life, I mean, I'm sure you've thought about this because often you find with empathetic people, they're able to, if we take it for granted that you're empathetic, which we will give you this.
Yes.
They're also able to have a little bit of perspective and a bit of self-awareness. Self-awareness being, in my view, an extremely good thing. And did you ever wonder that your life, of course, it is lopsided in the sense that you have seen, experienced, thought about, written about, explored, developed, fictionalized, had it rubbed off on you, extreme amounts of trauma, personal trauma experienced by other people. I'm sure you've wondered over the years, where is that trauma going? And can it be stored up? And does it need an exit? Does it need... Do you ever wonder, does that trauma become... there's a receptacle in your conscious that takes that trauma, and that somewhere it may cause you some, I don't know, some damage or something. And if not, is there some method by which you could deal with that potential trauma? For example, did you say you were talking about therapy and counselling? Mm-hmm. Is this something that alludes to what I'm talking about?
Yes. Oh, look, another reason why I think subconsciously I've called it black light. You know, it's about darkness in people. I'm a darker person now than I was when I started journalism. I'm a more anxious person. I worry a lot. I look at life through, if I'm a camera and I'm a camera lens, I've got a darker filter on it. Do you know what I mean?
Of course I do.
And, you know, people ask me this because look, I've covered 800 homicides, right? But I've covered, if you take homicides and car crashes and plane crashes and drownings and everything, I've probably covered 1,500 people losing their lives. Yeah. And look, I'll give you an example. Every year, Women's Aid do a list of women murdered, women and female children murdered, right? From 1996, right? I think it's about 278, something like that, right? And I help them. I would have helped them with some statistics because I kept my own murder board, if you want to say, with details about who was killed where, and they wouldn't have had, they may have missed some. So I would have helped them out. But they release, there's a press release, right? And there's a database of victims, you know, women victims, right? And I would look at it, more than, say, between 280 and 300. And I would go, I remember her. I got that photograph. I spoke to her father. Her brother was done. Her husband was done. I remember them all. So of that 280, there's maybe 30, 40 that I didn't work on. And that's an awful lot of victims. And I look, and, you know, let me give an example. The Uma bomb happened. Three young children were killed from Bunkrana in Donegal. That was on a Saturday. On the Sunday, when I was with the Irish News, and we were all doing it, I knocked on three doors in Bunkrana. And I got two photographs. So the photographs that you see, when the photographs are put up are the victims, I got those two photographs. And the third family, and this is terrible, I remember it, they've said, please leave us alone. And I walked away. And I, you know, you feel like a dirt bike. But there was another case about 2 days later. There was a British female journalist. You sort of, when it's a big story like this, you sort of work together because there's no point five journalists calling the house five times in a row. So there was an English journalist there. And I said, I'm the local fella. Why don't I do the door knock? I remember who it was actually. I can still see him standing in the garden. He'd lost his daughter. He's a young girl. And it was a garden that had no boundaries, so no walls or fences or anything like that. And I walked over and I said, how you doing, sir? You know, we're from the press. Would you mind talking to us? And he went, do you want to talk? And I went, no problem. Very sorry for your loss. And I walked away, and I remember the female journalist went, what? Not even a word, right? And that, it's amazing the things that stick with you. That was 25 years ago nearly, and I still remember her going, being so aggressive to him. So look, what I'm saying is, it's not a good thing that all these things have affected me, because what sort of person would you be if you had covered so much tragedy and it didn't affect you?
Yes.
I think that's a, you know...
That's another way of looking at it.
Do you know what I'm saying? Yeah. You know, I would be a psycho or whatever.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And why? Why this area of your life? So I mean, I was saying to Cabrina before... Mm. I was saying to Cabrina before you came in. I said, I don't get it. And she went, what? I don't get it. The whole podcast crime thing, right? Mm. Now, I admire deeply all the people who do it. I do a very successful impression of some of them on the radio, and they're some of the sketches that I enjoy most. But one of my previous guests on the podcast, Muireann O'Connell, Cabrina reminded me, she was editing it, said, I fall asleep to these true crimes. As the man slashed his neck in two, Muireann is just a...
And women love it.
What the hell are... What?
Women love it. Women love true crime. I don't
why?
Know why.
I haven't got a clue. Listen, to me. See, for
you
me.
Like true crime?
I, you know, look, listen, I do...
But what are we storing up for ourselves, Michael? As if life wasn't traumatic enough. Well, can't buy a house. Interest rates going up. What you need is a slasher true crime to get you to sleep.
It's... Do you know what? I've thought about this because, see, Netflix and stuff. The Dahmer one.
Yeah.
I don't know, see the Dahmer? I watched that for 5 minutes. I went, no thanks.
Why?
Because I've seen it in real life, and why would I want to watch some fella?
But you're an exception to the rule.
Oh, yes, I know. And
it's voyeurism, isn't it? Into the dark side. It's the dark heart of evil.
I'm going to tell you, violence, even though I'm a crime reporter, violence, it turns my stomach. Right, I remember when you were in school and there were fights.
Yeah.
Right. I remember seeing the fight happening and I would have a sick feeling in my stomach.
Me too.
And I would walk away.
I feel like that.
I literally walked away.
I remember just, this is nothing.
No.
This is nothing. I remember I might have been 17 thinking I was into town, or 16 maybe, 15, and going, I'm going to McDonald's in Grafton Street, going into town, and I'm going to buy myself a pair of jeans and I'm going to be cool. 15, going to go to U2 on my own. And I remember I went into McDonald's on Grafton Street and these two really big men just started kicking off about 3 o'clock in the afternoon in Grafton Street, in the McDonald's, really kicking off. And both of them knew how to fight. Yeah. Jesus, I remember feeling physically ill at there was teeth flying everywhere, there was blood. They were really belting each other. And I remember not being, you don't even see that in the movies or on TV really. Violence is different in real life. And I remember just feeling sick.
Yeah.
It really turned my stomach.
So for me, it's not the what or the how, it's the why. My interest is, why do people do this?
Okay, right? So you're psychologically intrigued.
I mean, to be totally anarchy, every Garda district in Dublin has a letter. Okay. Now, I had to fictionalise the Garda district. So we're in B at the minute, which is Pier Street. Okay. A is Kevin Street, C is the Store Street, D is the Bridewell. You know, it's all over, right? M is Talla and with Farnham, everywhere, right? There's one called Y, and I fictionalised that. It's Balbriggan, and I brought it in from Balbriggan. The story is set in central Dublin, and I called the Garda District. Its name was, number was, a letter was Y. And that's a play on words, because for me it's all about the WHY, the Y, right? So my interest in is, and when I do stories about murders, it's not, this is how they were killed, it's, why did he kill her? Right. And that's what really is fascinating for me. Now, I do think some people are into gore for whatever reason. And, you know, we mentioned women there, right? When you're trying to, the way it works is you get an agent and then the agent tries to get you publishing deals, right? And I got an awful lot of feedback in this version that I was happy with, right? And one of the things that depressed me the most, they all said, Michael, it's really well written. It's very pacey, great storyline. But it's not for women.
And they were looking for the women's vote.
Oh, yeah. And
what do you have to do to get into the women?
Well...
Go on.
You're going to get me in trouble here.
No, you know the answer to this question. I can see it in your face.
Of course
you just
I
have
do.
To tell me.
You,
how do you get to the women?
Well...
I want the real answer.
I'm going to give you an answer, right?
The truth is always better,
the truth,
Michael.
People
will know
this is my truth. I think... the publishing industry is making a mistake by not trusting women. Okay? They want women. They think women want a sort of slightly sanitized version of crime. Okay? And my book is about a sexual assault on as a woman as she's walking home. It's about a woman who's raped and murdered. It's about a guard fighting child sexual abuse material. It's about a guard saving a young girl from a man who has groomed her, who also happens to be a major criminal. So it's all real, right? And my, it's not based on reality, but it's authentic, okay? And I have to say, with regret, and you're going to get me in trouble for this, I think most people in the publishing trade, because they told me, they said the book was too blokey. That's one of the things that really annoyed me. They said it's not really for women, it's too blokey, right? And I think that they don't trust women. They think that women sort of want to be tantalised, but don't show them the reality, okay? And one of the things that I've been happiest about this...
But what you learned is that that's the opposite.
Well, I can only tell you the
this
reaction...
is what you're saying, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
So you're saying women want the full Monty.
No, I'm saying trust and respect women.
Yeah.
No, don't give it a filter. Yeah. Don't sit there and go, oh my God, there's a thing called cozy crime. I only heard about it last week and it winds me up. There's nothing cozy about crime. Okay. There is fuck all cozy about crime, let me tell you, right? And all this cozy crime, Miss Marple, you know, people living in nursing homes solving crime, it's all bollocksology, right? Crime is people being hurt. And it's about guards and law enforcement doing their best to protect people and to get justice for the victims, right? So I think that an awful lot of crime fiction, I'm going to be dead for this, is there's a wee, you know, it's like a mirror or a glass frame is put in front of real crime. And, you know, you can look at it like this. You can be sort of titillated, but don't make it real. My book's real. And the thing that has pleased me most about the reaction to this book is two things. Guards have said to me, you know far too much about my job, right? Because that's what I set out to do. I want, how do I always get myself in the doo-doo? An awful lot of crime fiction does not reflect the reality of policing in Ireland, okay? Just, it doesn't. And mine does. Mm. That's, you know, there's rows, there's guards being overpromoted, there's incompetence here acting the bollocks with their sergeants and stuff, right? And there's guards who are doing their best every day. I haven't read much Irish crime fiction, sadly, that reflects the reality of policing and, again, of journalism. Mm. So the thing that pleased me is the guard said, Mick, you nailed it. You absolutely nailed it. Fair play. And the other thing that pleased me was lots of women have read it and said, fuck me, this book's great. Mm. And they really, really liked it. And women who I respect... And they did it unbidden. And they said, mate, your book was brilliant. It was really, really good because it didn't take the piss out of women.
Yeah.
And I think an awful lot of fiction does that. With in all modesty, it's a page turner.
Yeah.
People say it's a very page turner. It's fast and it's pacey and no problem.
No.
But it's real.
Yeah.
And it's authentic.
Well, I'll tell you, as well as being a very interesting guest, Michael, you've sold me as well.
Oh,
fair play to you, yeah.
Excellent.
Now, there's a few people listening to this podcast live.
Oh dear.
Do you know that?
I didn't know that.
They're live. They could be anywhere.
Oh my goodness.
There are a lot of important people who listen to this podcast.
Oh no.
Some of them are going around in their cars.
Oh Jesus.
Some of them
Christ.
Are in their offices. Some of them are at their workplace of work.
Right.
So a load of them are listening to it. And I'm always informed on the phone of who's listening live.
Am I going to be sued here?
No, not at all.
Did I sign an indemnity thing beforehand?
They're listening live. So the first caller is Fintan O'Toole.
Oh,
Say hello to Fintan. Say hello to him.
Oh, hello Fintan.
Hi Michael. It's Fintan O'Toole here. I've been thinking of diluting my extremely intellectual work and my art and my commitment to great writers like Joyce and Beckett and so on and so forth. And I've been thinking of going down, sort of branching downwards into the lower echelons of the Star. So I was thinking of writing maybe a crime column every week for the Irish Times. But I'm struggling with finding the requisite vocabulary. I think it is because my vocabulary is, you know, polysyllabic.
Yes.
It is multisyllabic.
Yes.
It is extremely penetrative and it is extremely psychologically, I would say, in a sense, brilliant.
Okay.
But what I need is more simpler, blunter language. And I thought maybe you are the chiselsmith by which I could attain this language. So I'm looking for some words. Please.
Yeah, no problem. So, just make it strong.
No, it's some words. Words for that I can use in my column in the Irish Times that describe awful people.
Horrific, evil, monster.
Horrific, hold on. Yeah, evil.
Monster.
Monster. Is this a monster in the Nosferatu way, in the Bela Lugosi way? Is this a monster in a psychological? Is Sigmund Freud involved?
I talked to my agent.
Okay, what about Thorag?
Thug. I use thug. It's great thug. I only found that out. Actually, there were the Hasashins.
Okay.
Thugs were an Indian sect of mad killers.
No, I know this.
Please. I'm sure. Of course you do.
Don't patronise me. Sorry. Patronising means to talk down to somebody, by the way. let me see. Thug. What about Thorag?
No, I don't like Thorag. It's very English.
Scumbucket.
No, no. You know what? I don't like the word scumbag or scumbucket.
Psycho killer?
Psycho.
Qu'est-ce que c'est?
Oui, oui.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Can I tell you my Irish Times story?
Good day. Yes, go on ahead.
Well, I'll tell you my Fenton story.
There's a story concerning me. I'm always interested.
Yeah, yeah. I always see him at the journalism awards.
Yeah, I know. Right? I've seen you. Look at me.
And I always meet him in the toilets and I go, "Hi, Uncle Fenton." And he's not. And he probably gets bored of it. But every year I've had a few months drink. And I always go, "Fenton, are we cousins? You're my uncle." And he goes, "He's very nice and very charming."
You're right. You're wrong on two fronts.
Oh.
You're wrong. I am not your uncle. Uh-huh. You're right that I do get bored of it.
Oh, that's fine. That's fair enough.
Thank you. Goodbye.
Wow, that was electrifying. I was on the edge of my seat here. Two master journalists going head to head, and you were so helpful to him as well. Miriam O'Callaghan is on the line. Oh, say dear. Hello to Miriam.
Hi, Miriam.
Hi, Michael. First of all, why did you do Claire Byrne, but you haven't done me?
Talk to my agent.
No, I'm talking to you. I reached out to your agent, but unfortunately they said, you know, if you want to find out, ask Michael himself. So, okay, you didn't do me, but you did Claire.
Yes, I'm very sorry about that.
Okay.
Claire really said she liked the book, so maybe if Miriam had said she liked the book, I would have done it as well.
No, but some of the things that you said today really resonated with me. Like, I hate cosy crime as well.
Okay.
I like it when there's just blood and guts everywhere. Real gory shit.
Is that why she works in RTE?
Absolutely. Okay. Blood on the carpet all over the place.
Excellent.
So I love it. So I think you were right, genuinely. Thanks, Michael, for everything that you do and everybody that you help. I hope you've stored up the trauma.
When I make it big, she may interview me for real.
Not after this, she won't.
No, maybe not. Okay, right, fair enough.
There's another caller on the line, and it's Frank Greeny.
Oh, Frank.
Frank Greeny.
I know Frank.
Hi, Michael. Frank Greeny here.
Ireland's most handsome crime reporter.
Very handsome, yeah. Thank you very much.
Yeah, very handsome.
And I just wanted to ask you a couple of questions, Michael. Is there a fraternity of crime writers out there? So, for example, I am now entering that space where I talk to Matt Cooper and I tell him about the criminals I've seen in court. There's other crime writers, Paul Williams,
yes.
Nicola Tallant,
yes.
yourself, Paul yes. Reynolds, there yes. is a crime correspondent.
Yes.
Is there a fraternity of crime people? Should there be fraternity of crime people? Should we ever meet for a drink, share stories? Do we ever meet for a drink, or do ye ever meet for a drink and I'm not invited?
This is serious. We have a very elite WhatsApp crime reporters group.
I'm not in it.
No, very few people are. There's only...
Thanks, Michael. Fuck that for a game of soldiers. So, talk to you later.
God, he's a bit bitter. One of your colleagues is on the line as well. Eamon Dunphy.
Oh, Eamon.
Hi. Michael, great to talk to you. You're a great writer. And I just was disappointed to learn that Miss Marple wasn't real.
That's my job. I tell people the truth.
But I love those programmes. Jessica Fletcher, Murder, She Wrote, and the Midsummer Murders. These are great comfort to people who are, you know, trailblazers of society. We write what we do, but we need to relax.
Eamon, I don't do happy. It's my job to tell the truth.
No.
That's it.
No, you don't. You don't. You are the truth. That's why we love you in the star. It's far and star.
Oh, fantastic stuff. God, you have great support out there. That's
good
support.
To know. Thanks.
Michael, listen, congratulations on the book. It's called Blacklight. And I really do want to read it now after the way you
just
sold it.
Just as well, I bought you a copy.
Can I have it?
Of course.
Oh,
yeah,
that's
I'm
very
sign
kind
it for
of you. Thank you so much. Sign it there. And a really interesting conversation and great to get to know you on a small level as well, and how clever and intelligent you are and how interested in psychology and all that. And I really, really enjoyed our chat. And thanks for coming in to me today, and best of luck with the book. And I hope you go on to continue to write more books.
Thanks very much.
And my thanks to Michael O'Toole for sharing all of those great stories with me. My thanks to you for listening as well. And remember, as I always ask you, if you want to contact me personally, it's mariorosenstock@gmail.com. Anything you like, comments, criticisms, constructive,
Or even suggestions for guests or sketches. I'm willing to listen to anything that you have to say. So send them over to mariorosenstock@gmail.com. And please tell one other person, if you can, if you like this podcast, tell one other person about it. I'll see you same time, same place, back here next week. Bye-bye.